Economic trouble in Greece this year has led to violent protests, high unemployment, and widespread debate about whether the country would or should default on its debts. One decade ago, that was the scene in two South American countries. Argentina and Uruguay both defaulted, but the two handled the economic calamity in very different ways. Now, economists say their approaches could be instructive for European leaders. NPR's Juan Ferrero has that story from Buenos Aires.
Some economists fear that Greece, on the brink of default, could suffer the same fate as Argentina, one of the best-known cases of economic turmoil. In 2001, police battled rioters in Buenos Aires, and there was a run on bank deposits. The country couldn't pay its bills. So President Adolfo Rodríguez Sá, who served just 1 week, announced before Congress that Argentina would default. And then, in patriotic fervor, everyone shouted, Argentina, Argentina. It was the biggest default in history, $100 billion. Economists say the chaotic response from Argentine leaders was a recipe for disaster. They failed to heed years of warnings, and then the government froze bank accounts and defaulted without negotiating with creditors. That's economist Victor Becker recounting how poverty rose to nearly 50% and millions were instantly unemployed. Argentina also became a pariah for investors. John Taylor was an undersecretary at the U.S. Treasury Department who dealt with the Argentine fallout. Taylor, who's now teaching economics at Stanford, says countries often wait too long to diagnose their own financial problems.
In crises like this, there is a tendency to think that another loan will tide you over to the next year or the next 2 years when things are better and you'll have access to the markets again. But so often, and it certainly is the case in Greece, they had to have a write-down, and more loans were not going to be the answer.
A write-down, meaning a default. But Taylor has in mind an orderly and negotiated default involving international creditors. That was the case in the country of 3.5 million people across the River Plate from Argentina, Uruguay. Like Argentina, Uruguay had a run on banks in 2002 and couldn't pay its bills. But Uruguay's response was all calm pragmatism, according to Argentine economist Orlando Ferreres. Ferreres recently met with 70 European businessmen who came to Buenos Aires to learn about the Argentine and Uruguayan defaults. The Uruguay solution was telling creditors, we can't pay at all, Ferreres says, but we can pay you 80% by extending payments. Nearly all of Uruguay's creditors accepted. Uruguay also negotiated a $1.5 billion bridge loan from the U.S. Treasury Department, and it made cuts to pensions and salaries. What happened since can also serve as a lesson for Greece. Both Argentina and Uruguay have seen their economies expand dramatically thanks to booming Asian demand for agro products that took off soon after their defaults. That growth generated adoration from Argentine supporters of President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, fueling her re-election in October. But the effects of how the two countries responded to the crisis are still readily apparent in their access to capital markets. Only 5 months after defaulting, Uruguay was once again able to borrow internationally. Argentina, on the other hand, is effectively barred from borrowing on the open market. 10 years later, it uses central bank reserves and the nationalized pension system to fund a big spending government. Juan Ferrero, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We've been learning more about the lives of the long-term unemployed as part of a series called Still No Job. NPR and the Kaiser Family Foundation conducted a poll of people who have been out of work or working only part-time for more than a year. They were asked where they get help. As NPR's Kathy Lohr reports, very few said they receive aid from community groups.
The survey shows people who've been out of a job for a while are getting help from family and friends, but the vast majority, about 70%, say they've received no help from nonprofits or community groups. Liz Hamill with the Kaiser Family Foundation says there are several reasons. Some may not know resources are available, and others want help that nonprofits may not provide.
So they may be looking for specific job placement services or help with job training, and may be having difficulty finding that in their local community.
But as friends and family get tapped out, community and church organizations say the long-term unemployed do turn to them.
I'm amazed.
Darlene Duke is the director of the Christian Aid Mission Partnership, known as CAMP. It's in Austell, Georgia, just west of Atlanta, where Duke sees 1,000 to 1,200 families every month, about twice the number she saw before the recession hit.
Knowing what the unemployment rate is and that few people say they're getting help from nonprofit organizations, I would just be amazed to know if there were still yet 90% of folks out there to come to me, because we're overwhelmed now.
The waiting room here is filled with families and the elderly applying for aid or picking up food. The unemployment rate in Georgia is around 10%, but in this area it's higher, and it's a challenge to find a good-paying job. Alma George is a single mom who was laid off in 2008 from her job in retail design. It paid about $40,000 a year. She now works part-time at CAMP, helping others apply for aid.
I've come across, you know, gentlemen that have been always the only, you know, provider that have come to me in tears. What do? I'm so ashamed. I'm embarrassed.
And George says her own life has changed dramatically. Her church is helping make her house payment, and she has little money for extras, including a church camp her son wanted to attend in nearby Villa Rica, but she didn't have the gas money to get him there.
He has to take me back and forth to work and take us to church on Sundays. There's not enough gas to take you to Villa Rica, you know. But I've seen a lot more cases that are worse off than me.
Across town in the more affluent Atlanta suburb of Sandy Springs, people line up to get fresh bread, veggies, and whatever meat is available. Many don't know the Community Action Center is here unless they are referred, says Tamara Correra, the executive director.
The poverty here is not so obvious because you don't see people, you know, with scruffy clothes and half naked with no shoes or whatever, but they're barely making it.
The center has helped about 5,000 people this year with rental assistance, utilities, clothing, and food.
Have a blessed day. Thank you. Hello. All right, why don't you come over here?
Among those in line, a young couple, Heather Oceaner, who says she's disabled with a neurological disorder, and her boyfriend, Matthew Prince. He is underemployed.
We live together. I have three part-time jobs that I'm just, you know, trying to string together enough for us both to survive.
Prince says he was working full-time as a security guard and then for a deli until his hours were cut.
And you see it's all kinds of people from all walks of life. It's not just, you know, typical people you would think of as being impoverished. Like, it's everybody needs the help, you know, every little piece they can get.
I mean, there are, like, days like today when we have $20 to our name and we can't get any food, and we can come here and we know we're going to be able to eat tonight, and that's a huge deal.
This couple had to turn to community groups for help because Matthew Prince says he can't find one good full-time job. Kathy Lohr, NPR News, Atlanta.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Lynn Neary.
And I'm Robert Siegel. In Europe, the financial crisis was first felt in small, heavily indebted countries, countries such as Greece and Ireland. But these days, wealthy countries are feeling more pain, and that includes the Netherlands. The Dutch government says the country has probably slipped into a recession. NPR's Jim Zeroli has our story.
With a population of just 16.5 million people, the Netherlands is one of the most vital economies in the West. It has low unemployment, a high savings rate, and a strong export base. It has world-class companies like Philips and Unilever. But these days, the mood in the country is gloomy. At the Amsterdam Central train station at a rush hour on a weekday, it isn't hard to find people who are worried about losing their jobs. People like Ada Berkelman.
Now many companies are letting go of people because there's no employment anymore, because there's no finance. And I think the number of unemployed people is increasing. I've seen that in my own company.
Or this man named Peter, who didn't want his last name used because he works for the government and doesn't want to jeopardize his job.
People, they are waiting for what's coming. It's difficult to buy new houses, to get new jobs, so that's affecting everyone.
Unemployment was very much on the mind of Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte last month when he paid a call on President Barack Obama at the White House.
I came to the United States basically to discuss three issues: jobs.
Those are good issues to discuss.
These are the main issues at the moment.
Simply put, the Netherlands is feeling the brunt of the debt troubles plaguing Europe.
The economic forecasts are deteriorating a lot, and this has everything to do with the euro crisis.
Economist Bas Jacobs of Erasmus University Rotterdam says much of Dutch trade is with other European countries, and as they head into a recession, the Netherlands will follow.
The Dutch economy is a small economy, and it's extremely reliant on world trade. We cannot, like the U.S., largely control our own economic destiny. We are going up and down with the tides in world trade.
The unemployment rate is still just 5.8%, but it's rising fast. With the economy slowing, the Netherlands' small budget deficit is widening, and Rutte's government is pushing through tax hikes and cuts in areas like education and transportation. There's been talk of reducing the lavish tax deductions that the government allows on mortgage interest. The Dutch are a thrifty people, but they have amassed some of the highest levels of mortgage debt in Europe. Hans de la Porte, a spokesman for the homeowners lobby, concedes that the deductions have encouraged people to buy houses they couldn't afford.
We've had this belief that housing prices can only go up. We've forgot that anything that goes up can go down.
Delaporte says that's a big risk for the banks. They're settled with high mortgage debt that could sour if the recession lasts too long, a problem that should sound all too familiar to Americans. But Delaporte says cutting the deduction now would be the wrong thing to do.
If you do away with it altogether at once, then you have the biggest economic crisis and crash that you can ever imagine.
Some politicians also want to cut the country's generous foreign aid budget. Closer to home, one government official has proposed scaling back unemployment benefits for people who refuse to move for a job. But Bas Jacobs says it's not clear whether any of this will be enough because the future is so murky.
Everything is now critically determined by the question whether our leaders are able to devise plans to stop this euro crisis or not. And things are rather scary at the moment, I must admit.
The Netherlands is a country that consistently punches above its weight economically. But the truth is that as this debt crisis drags on, its fate is very much outside its hands. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
Online retail is seeing a healthy spike this holiday season. According to the web research firm Comscore, between Thanksgiving and last week, online sales were up 15% over last year. And as NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports, it's largely because consumers are finding more ways to avoid the shopping mall.
Gian Fulgoni estimates 90% of his holiday dollars were spent online. Of course, Fulgoni is chairman of Comscore, which monitors online traffic, but he says the things that appeal to him increasingly appeal to the broader shopping audience.
The two drivers of e-commerce are convenience and price.
Fulgoni says this year there was more free shipping and retailers continued to discount. And for the first time, he says a sizable number of shoppers, about 8 to 9%, use their smartphones or tablets to buy.
And what's happening is that people are taking these devices, they're going into a physical store, touching and feeling the product, and then before they're ready to buy, they scan the barcode on the product, they're off online and finding a better price. And that's causing some real issues at retail, because they're finding that they're competing with the internet in their own stores, which is, as some have said to me, their worst nightmare.
Still, business isn't collapsing for brick-and-mortar stores. They're expected to also do better than last year. The National Retail Federation expects overall holiday sales to increase by almost 4%. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.